to clearly formulate it. And that's the question of, and it's a problem that arises all the time, it's a question of how to deal with the termination of a contract, in this case an employment contract, through an event that's not the fault of either party. Right? We've been discussing up until now the question of what happens if one of the two parties retracts. We discussed the right to strike, we addressed unionization, we sort of have various different principles. But now we have to discuss a situation in which there was a contract, for example, and then something happens, some unforeseen event occurs, some accident occurs. Who bears the risk? Well, bankruptcy is not necessarily one of these things, but I might be talking about a hurricane, or it could be bankruptcy of a third party that you neither you nor the person that you're dealing with was prepared for.
So this is pre-insurance?
Hmm?
Pre-insurance.
It's sort of not relevant to insurance. These kinds of things will occur even in today when we're fully insured.
I mean, which insurance company?
Yeah, because like I said, Gary's in reinsurance where they insure other companies for disasters.
Yeah, but this isn't necessarily a disaster. In other words, this might be an error in judgment. It might be an event that was unforeseen, but not necessarily a disaster. For example, it could be a death of a party. Tonight we will look into a number of cases of opinions having to deal with the death of a party. And you know, how do you deal with it? Someone rents an apartment and then dies in the middle of the lease. Is the estate responsible for the remainder of the lease, or are they not responsible for the remainder of the lease? I mean, there's no clear-cut, hard and fast rule to tell you how to decide such a case. And in fact, we'll see that on an issue like that, it's a machlokas between the Rashba and the Maharam. We have a decision on that matter, that is, the Ashkenazi tradition has a definite decision on that matter, but it's certainly not an obvious kind of a case to deal with. A person hires a tutor for his son, and the son dies in the middle. I mean, it's a great tragedy, of course, but also the tutor is out of a job for the rest of the year. Is this contract to be immediately terminated with no further payments to him? Right? I mean, it's not clear that any insurance, we're not talking about great big things which are normally insured, covered by insurance policies, and the question is just how to deal with these cases. So, first of all, what are some principles that we can operate with? One principle that we can operate with is obviously anything that is explicitly stipulated. If one of the other parties explicitly stipulates that he will bear the risk, right? If it's written into the contract that even if the tenant dies, the estate is obligated to pay for the rent for the rest of the year, if that's explicitly written into the rental contract, then we don't have any trouble with it. And conversely, if it's explicitly written into the rental contract that the death of the tenant automatically terminates the lease, then we also don't have any trouble with it. So these are, in a sense, problems which could have been prevented had all possible contingencies been thought of, and had they had good lawyers who would write down in detail all of the possible different eventualities and stipulate them. So if that's the case, we have no trouble. If there's a local practice, we have no trouble. Right? There's a general rule that there can be an implicit stipulation, that is, a contract normally is meant to follow the local practice. So, for example, I don't know what the law is. You tell me what the law is in this state of Massachusetts. What is the state law about a tenancy which is...
State's liable.
Hmm? The estate is liable. Okay, for example. Now, so therefore, if, for instance, there's the local custom is that it's understood that the estate is always liable for the term of the lease, then we have no problem with that. I mean, there's no clear moral or other legal issue that's involved. And obviously, as in all economic things, the issue of who bears the burden, who bears the risk, is eventually passed on in a cost term, in terms of price. Right? I mean, I would imagine that if the rule, what, for example, if since the state of Massachusetts says that the estate is always liable in the case of the death of the party, if I had an old aunt who was living and I wanted to be sure that I really thought she was going to, the real good chance that she was going to die 2 months into the annual lease, I would raise the price of the rent. I'd be willing maybe to pay more money for the rent for the first couple of months while she was alive in order not to be liable for the rest, right? In other words, once there is a definite law, then that risk can be transferred to another party by simply raising or lowering the price in terms of how the case may be. So that therefore, this is something which can be assessed, can be estimated, and therefore the risk can be transferred explicitly by price.
Like, well, in New York, for example, where there's major things with rent control, I think that a lot of the landlords afford some of the tenants' types, they can rent to a much higher price. So I think maybe the law in New York might
be. That may very well be. As you say, there may be a situation in which...
Gives them a chance to break
away. Yeah, it may be a situation where it's not in the landlord's interest. And therefore, the landlord could explicitly write into the contract that in the case of the death of the tenant, the estate has no claims to the apartment and the lease is terminated. I mean, there's nothing in constitutional law that prevents such a contract from being written, which is goes against the self-understood municipal situation. So, but there is a slight important point here, a mildly important point, to be derived from this, and that is that if it's an absolutely free market, if there are no market costs in transferring the risk from one party to the other, it may not make much difference who bears the burden of the risk, because it will all be washed out in the eventual price. What's needed is a clear rule. But if, for example, the transaction costs are not so easy, for example, if the parties are in an unequal situation as far as being able to assess the risk, suppose one person, one party to the contract is in a much better situation to assess the risk than the other parties to the contract, then it makes sense to put the risk burden on him, because if he wants to sell it or avoid it, then he can adjust the price accordingly. So therefore, a principle that we will have is that the person who is, if you have a situation where one party is aware of all the possibilities and can assess the risk, and the other party is at a disadvantage because he couldn't have anticipated this event or was unaware of the information, then the burden of the risk will normally fall on the first party. Let's see some of these examples in the Gemara. These are easy. Then we get into some more complicated ones. These are easy. So let's turn to the third of the pages that I've passed out here. At the very bottom. Ki hada amarava, the second line from the bottom. Ki hada amarava, hai man da aga agire la rifka. A man hired workers to dig ditches or dikes in order to repair the irrigation system in his field. V'yata mitra umal yomai. And the rain came and filled up the field with water, and they were unable to do the work. Right? If the Baal HaBayit took the necessary precaution the night before of making sure that the field was workable, that is, he didn't hire these workers without knowing in advance that the field was fit for doing this kind of work, and then unexpectedly overnight it rained, then it's Pseida de Poali. Then the workers bear the burden. They simply lose out on their salary. Now they lose out on their pay. Lo siyarei la'arei megota. If the Baal HaBayit didn't check in advance that the field was, last night, was fit for work, and therefore for all we know it may have been an act of negligence on the Baal HaBayit's part for not of having ascertained that the field could have been worked, then say to the Baal HaBayit, Then the burden falls on the Baal HaBayit, on the household, on the landlord, on the landowner, and he pays them, but of course he deducts something because they're not working. The Amarova, Hayman de Ogir Agure Ledavla. If a person hires workers to raise water in buckets, you know, from the river into his irrigation system, right, to irrigate the fields, okay? Va'ata mitra, and rain came, so it was no longer needed to irrigate the fields. Seda de poalim. Ata nahara, however, if it wasn't rain, but rather there was a rise in the river, and the river naturally filled the irrigation system without having to raise the water by hand. Seda de baal habayit, v'yahiv l'hu kepoel batel, because the poalim would have no way. The Baal HaBayit would know that there's a possibility of the rivers rising. In the case of rain, you know, the Baal HaBayit and the Poel are equal. They both know that there's a chance of rain and therefore the work will not be necessary or possible. But in the case of the rising river flooding the field, doing the irrigation work by itself without their having to do the work, every field is situated differently. So that it's only the Baal HaBayit who can assess the risk of a rise in the river making the work unnecessary. The Poalim aren't in a position to make that assessment, and therefore he has to bear the burden of the risk.
What's the situation with the rain?
In the situation of the rain, they're both situations. The Poalim lose out.
Completely.
Yes. The principle here is the Rishonim call this Hamotzi Michavero Alov HaRa'aya, but really this isn't the question of having to prove anything. It's just the principle that all things being equal, we have no reason to transfer the burden. We just let the cost of the accident lie where it falls. We don't transfer it to another party without cause.
Is that why they have a
no.
The Baal, he benefited from
rain. Yeah, but why should he pay for work that isn't done? They lose out, but on the other hand, why should he pay for work that is unnecessary? So in a situation like this,
they can't go anywhere else to work. They lost that day.
They lost that day, right?
So it's a loss to them.
It's a loss to them. That's the law. Okay? Okay, now let's go again. The Amarava, Haiman de Ogir Agure Ledavla, Upasak Nahara Bapalga de Yoma. Suppose he hired workers again to irrigate the field by taking water in buckets from the river and putting it into the irrigation system. But this time the river ran dry. In the middle of the day, the river simply stopped. Ilo avid de pasak. If this is a rare occurrence, in other words, for the last 30 years the river never ran dry, but apparently there must have been some earthquake or landslide or something that blocked the river, dammed up the river upstream and cut off the river, then say to the Poalim. Then the burden lies on the Poalim. Because we have no reason to shift this particular burden from where it falls. Avid the Pasak, however, if this is a river that does run dry from time to time, this is not a rare event, then the Gemara says, Ibnei Mata, if the Poalim come from the same town, and therefore they know the behavior of this river just as well as the Baal HaBayit knows the behavior of the river, then since they didn't explicitly stipulate that they're to be paid in any event, they bear the burden of the risk. Say to the Poalim, Lav bnei mata. However, if the workers don't come from this town, and therefore they have no way of knowing that the river runs dry, and therefore they have no way of protecting themselves, putting in a clause saying that even if the river runs dry, we want some portion or all of our salary, then it's say to the Baal HaBayit.
They don't get paid.
They don't get paid. Okay, so these are various different illustrations, all of the same principle, namely that if the situation is that one party is in a better situation, able to assess the risk than the other, he is the one that bears the burden of the risk. Okay?
In these cases, if they had gotten paid in advance, would that change anything?
As far, most Rishonim will say no, it doesn't make any difference. This isn't really Hamotzi Mechavero Alavara. Okay. Here's, for example, a case, this is a little hard to read, because my my copy of the Shivas of the Maharam is yellow and crumbling with age, so the Xerox machine doesn't do too well by it. But here's a typical problem. It's a problem. Here's a Shiva of the Maharam. He wasn't there. Vishesha Alta. It's a Simon Tzadik. Vishesha Alta al Chazan Hashochetu Bodek LaKahal. You had a man who was generally hired by the community to be a chazan and to be the shochet and be to the bodek. Okay? Ve'eskiru lukach. And he was hired for these three jobs. Okay? Vahakatzavim eino menichim oto levdok machmat shehu shohe yoter midai bevdikato. But the butchers don't want to let him work because he takes too long. It's like your father-in-law with the shochtim unit, right? But, so, but this is, of course, from the 13th century, right? The butchers say, this guy takes too long to do the bdika on these animals. We don't want him. Hire somebody else, okay? And they claim, v'derech tavche goyim lahaktir. So this, again, gives you a picture. It's not only in Chicago that you have the kosher butcher, the kosher slaughterhouse, in the as a branch of the of the non-kosher.
My grandfather's the same way.
Yeah.
And that was in Washington. There was a small shop with the live animals, and people would come, and you know, he wanted to. They would kill one, and the other ones would kill.
Yeah. So in general, the arrangement that the Jewish butchers had was that the trefa meat was part of the.
Went to
the non-Jewish customers, but of course the goyim didn't want to wait around so long. Didn't want to wait the half an hour that the guy was taking to check the lungs and everything. So they fired him. Okay, on the claim that this man is taking too long to do the work and therefore he's incapable. So now what happens? Nira, he says, the lo gara migneva ve'aveda de gneva. That even if messengers were sent to transport the shkalim to the Beit HaMikdash and there was a theft, they still can demand their pay. He's liable for this damage. It's bad enough that he's not paying these people back. At least he should lose his wages as a punishment for negligence. This is not talking about the monies being stolen from him, but he was held up by highway robbers.
They stole the payroll.
They stole the payroll, and now do you pay the brinks?
Why are they out?
No, the question is, do you pay the Brinks delivery service after they've been held up? Do you pay the delivery charge? Right? So, and he says, the Gemara says that if it's really a hold up and they're not at fault, they're entitled to their salary. They did their best, it's not their fault. Alma, therefore he says, if there is an issue here of negligence, if this isn't a question of being completely beyond the control, Alma b'gneva v'yaveda shomer sachal mafsid, igra. V'chein mashma batarachi gabi asocher tabo'el l'shmo'at tabarat, as you know, as well, hilchach mafsid scharo. And therefore he says, since this man simply is, it's his lack of agility, he's just simply too slow on the job, therefore it's his liability, and if he can't use his powers of persuasion to persuade the butchers or to let him operate a little bit more slowly, it's his responsibility, and the community will find someone else and he'll be out his salary. Okay? The Kevin, and he says, Ilo Mufayes HaKatzavim Va'alei d'dei ram yelafai sinu. It's his, the chazan's, or the bodek's responsibility to convince the butchers. Kevan the kapti b'davar shekiyotzi bo makapti tavchi goyim. Since they are not out of line in demanding that he work at this speed, right? They're not saying that he has to do it in 3 seconds. But if they are saying, look, do this at the normal rate in which all butchers who deal with non-Jewish butchers and so on allow for the time of the bedikah, and he's taking too long, then it's his responsibility. Aval, he says, im makpidim b'davar she'ein tabchei goyim makpidim k'yotzebol klalu l'klal. But if the butchers are unreasonable, they're demanding that if you do all of this at such a speed that nobody else has heard of, ume'olam lo shama adam she'yakpidu b'kach, and nobody else heard that they should be responsible, that domi la'unsin, then it's as if this was a force majeure and it's not his responsibility.
So the group of people go down to determine this? How does this?
Okay, so what the Maharam is saying is we can have two extremes, but this guy is really a laggard, and any normal butcher would tell you that this guy is taking twice as long as anybody else, and butchers are not being unreasonable to ask him to finish the job in half an hour because everybody finishes it in half an hour, and he's taking 45 minutes or an hour. Okay. Then there's the other extreme. The other extreme is that he's unreasonable, right? That the butchers are making a reasonable demand. Okay. So either if the butchers are out of line, it's not his responsibility. If he's out of line, it is his responsibility. Now, what happens if the customs vary? Avim ein derech lahakpid sha'at habchei goyim mimakom shehabodek sham. Suppose the butcher comes, the bodek comes from New York. He goes from New York to Chicago, and in New York, the bodek is allowed to take 45 minutes. In Chicago, they insist that he finish the job in 20 minutes. Now, you imported this poor man from New York. You needed a shochet. You came there with his family, and all of a sudden, they're making him operate at twice the speed that he's normally accustomed to. That's what he says. Im ein derech lahakpid sha'at habchei goyim mimakom shehabodek sham. V'derech otam tabachim shebeirchem lahakpid b'kach. V'yadua lakahal shehem akpidim b'kach. And if this is something that was known in advance, that in Chicago the speed demanded of a bodek is twice as fast as the one in New York, ibay lakahal litnuya. Then the Kahal should have written this explicitly into their contract with the butcher before they imported him from New York. Ve'ilo itnu v'hai pseida deduha. But and if the community didn't make this explicit, it was not up to the butcher to know that the speed of bdika in Chicago was twice as fast as it was in New York. And if they didn't specify it in the contract, then it's their responsibility. Ve'ahivnele kepoel batel fishi adumin hagamakom v'hu lo yada. Because they were in a position to know what the local custom is, and he was not in a position to know. And since it's a situation where they are unequal in terms of their knowledge or an ability to protect themselves explicitly in the contract, it was up to the community to make this clause.
It's the same situation with the irrigation.
Yes, k'de amar perka umanim. That's exactly what the Maharam Wittenberg cites, our Gemara. Okay? So it's a very clear tshuva of Maharami Wittenberg, as usual. It lays out the principles very clearly that, in general, the person who is in the better position to know, he is the person that has to make the clauses explicit if necessary, or will bear the burden of the risk if necessary. It's up to the person who is in a better position to know to anticipate the problem and to bear the burden of the risk, because he can then assess it economically better than the other party. Okay, so this is a clear, easy principle. Now we'll come to a principle that's not so clear, but at least we can make some sense of. And the sense that I'm going to make of it is perhaps not the sense that the Gemara makes of it, that is, but is the sense that through the traditional usage of this particular halacha makes of it. Here, let's go to the first page. Hamakabel sadeh mechavero. Someone rents a field from the landlord, right? You have a tenant running a farm and paying a rent to the landlord, and then he keeps the crops, right? That's the situation. Hamakabel sadeh mechavero. V'achlo chagav onishtefa. Suppose that there was an insect attack. The crop was ruined by grasshoppers, or ruined by fungus, right? There was some type of a disease which completely ruined the crop. So the Gemara says, im makat medinahi, if this is a general epidemic, in other words, if this particular disaster struck the entire region, manakelo mechikugo, then the landlord has to rebate some of the rent to the tenant. Im eina makat medina, if this is not makat medina, ein menakelo mechikura. If this particular disaster struck only this field and not all fields, then the poor tenant has to pay the rent, and the landlord is not obligated to rebate the rent to the tenant just because he had the bad luck of the crop fail that particular year.
Would you call that like a hanacha at this time?
Yeah, if you like.
How come they didn't use this as a more picturesque language? They feel everything is hanacha or discount.
You like the word menakeh better?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Eino menakeh, Rashi says, if it's not a makat medina, eino menakeh, de amar lo mazal chagara. Your tough luck. Okay, now the question is, how do you interpret this phrase, your tough luck? No, I'm serious about this, because I think there's really a conceptual difference between the way Rashi, or maybe even the Gemara, would have interpreted the phrase, your tough luck, and the way we interpret the phrase, your tough luck. What do you mean when you say, your tough luck, Mr. Weinstein? What does it mean to you?
Could it happen to anybody? Did it happen to you?
Oh, random.
Like Murphy's Law.
Right. It could have happened to anybody, it happened to you, and you bear it because it happened to fall on you, right? I don't think that's what Rashi meant
this
by your tough
luck. This is where you deserved it somehow.
I don't think I think that's because we have a conception of chance and luck which has been conditioned for 200 or 300 years of probability theory, insurance, and all kinds of other things. So we take it for granted that there is such a thing as random events, and luck for you and for me, and I think for everyone sitting around this table, means a random event that could have happened to anybody and happened to you. Okay, whoever it happens to has to bear it. If you look at the way someone like Cardano writing in the 15th century, or any of the people who are writing on probability theory, say before Fermat and Pascal and the actual creators of the theory, their view of the situation was different. Their view of the situation was that man could be lucky or unlucky. Being lucky or unlucky didn't mean that a random event which was fortunate happened to him or didn't happen to him. It was actually a trait of his personality. Being lucky meant, for someone who may not have been Jewish, that the goddess of fortune smiled on him, and therefore, in all types of games of chance or whatever, he had a tendency to win. Being lucky meant that you had a tendency to win. I mean, and if you look at someone like Cardano's book, I mean, he has lots of chapters on how to cheat at cards. But, no, but you have to understand this. Cheating means that you're coming into a game, like for example, suppose I went into the boxing ring with Muhammad Ali, right? I better learn some tricks. I better learn some tricks on how to deal with the situation, because it's an uneven match. If I go into a card game with a lucky opponent, it's an uneven match. He's lucky, not being lucky means that he will tend to win at a card game because that's his nature. You don't take that. Well, that's what you see. That's what the phrase "mazalo garam" means. "Mazalo garam" means that he was born under the good constellation, and therefore the constellation protected him, tended to make him win in these various games.
Everybody has a, you know, even somebody who supposedly has the stars shining on them, has something happens to. How do they explain that?
Well, it doesn't mean that he wins every game, right? If you're lucky, it doesn't necessarily mean that you win every game of poker that you play. But overall, you will tend to win more than the other guy. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with skill.
But what about, like, Job, supposedly? That's like a major change. That's not...
Yeah, sure. But if you believe that everybody has an angel or a constellation looking after him, right? If you have your constellation watching out for you so that you will tend to win, and your constellation is better at it than my constellation, for example, then you're going to win more often than me. So you see, I think that there was a tendency in Rashi here to take that point of view, and that when the landlord says to the balabayit, tough luck, he doesn't mean that some random event happens and you just have to bear it, but he's saying something a little bit different, which is unacceptable to us. I think unacceptable to anyone sitting around this table. He is saying to him that you're a man, you're a shlemazel.
You could have rented somebody else's property.
And you would have rented somebody else's property. It would have happened to you there or any place else you would have gotten. You're just a schlemazel. Yeah. The word schlemazel in Yiddish means, schlem means bad. Schlemazel means is a person who has bad luck. It's a property of this individual to just be accident prone. Oh, he's a loser.
Under a dark cloud.
Okay. If that's the interpretation, if that's the interpretation, of course, the landlord can't make that claim if it's a makat medina. Makat medina means that this fungus attack hit all the fields. If it's a general epidemic, then obviously it's not the fault, in quotation marks, of the tenant, that the thing happened to this particular field, because it happened to everybody. And therefore, since it's not the fault of the tenant, it makes sense that the landlord can no longer claim that it's the tenant's fault, and therefore the landlord will have to bear at least a part of the cost. Okay?
Did the interpretation of this change as probability theory came along?
Yeah, I think so. I think that if we examine how this actually is enforced in practice, and if I have time next week, is there going to be a shiur next week, by the way? I'll be in town. It's the first night of Hanukkah, so if it's all right for everybody, it's all right for me. You know, you may have some family functions or something. Okay, so we'll come next week.
Well, with good luck.
Okay, so I think that a perfectly acceptable modern interpretation of this Mishnah has nothing to do with luck, and it has to do with something else. And it has to do a little bit with what you are asking, and that is that in a situation where there really is a general disaster, you want to shift the burden to the people who are best able to pay. In other words, in a case where you have one tenant who's out of a job, okay, it happens, the community will come around and support it. But if you have a situation where all the tenants are out of a job, then the community can't any longer organize itself to help feed 1,000 homeless people. They can maybe help feed 10 or 20. And therefore, if it's a general epidemic, you're going to tend to shift at least a portion of the burden to the richer classes. And in practice, if you look at the way this particular halacha actually works out, we will find that that's what happens. Because in general, no matter what the reason is, the burden is shifted to the Baal HaBayit. Remember, in a case where you have a landlord versus a tenant, then the landlord is sort of analogous to the poel, right? He is providing the service, in this case, the property, and the tenant is analogous to the employer, right? But in all cases, where you actually see this, the Baal HaBayit is really the rich man, and the burden being shifted to the Baal HaBayit is always the burden being shifted from the weaker classes to the richer.
So that's another principle that I think that we can accept. In a situation where there's a general disaster, the normal rules are suspended and the burden is shifted to those people who are able to pay. So it's sort of a form of insurance, if you like, but it's a collective insurance, and it's an insurance for the system as a whole, where the normal local charities just would not be capable of dealing with helping out one individual because there are too many of those individuals around to deal with.
Okay.
So that's, again, a principle that we can understand, and in practice that's how it works.
We go back for a minute to the earlier understanding of Mazal.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not a random event, but it's sort of a characteristic phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Then that makes a person's Mazal now a piece of information.
About him.
It should come into the Cheshbon in assessing the risk.
Oh yeah, sure.
So when we apply the rule of the person best able to assess the risk.
Well, I don't know if it goes that far, but that's at least the landlord's claim. Whether we will take it that far, I don't know. Okay. Okay. Now comes a Gemara which I've never understood. I have a way of passing at it, but and it arises all the time. That is, it's quoted all the time, and I'll make a pass at a reinterpretation, but I don't really have an understanding. And this is on Daf Ayin Tet. Let's take a look at Daf Ayin Tet on the bottom. Tanu Rabbanan. It's about four lines from the bottom. Tanu Rabbanan. Hasocher et hasfina, v'tav'a la b'chatzi haderech. A wine merchant rents a boat to ship his wine, and the boat sinks in the middle. So the wine merchant is out of boat, is out his cargo of wine, and the boat owner is out his boat. But the question is, what happens to the rental? Okay? Are you still obligated to pay the rent? So Rabbi Natan Omar, it's a question now for paying for the rental on the rest of the way that that you haven't. Okay. So Rabbi Natan Omar, the strange halacha, im Natan lo yitol, v'im lo Natan lo yiten. That if there's been prepayment, then if a wine merchant prepaid the shipping, then he can't get his money back. And if he didn't prepay his shipping, then he doesn't have to pay. In other words, apparently what Rabbi Natan is saying is that if the wine merchant prepaid for the shipment, that is a sign that he was willing to assume the burden of the risk. And therefore, he assumes it. And if he didn't prepay, then the presumption is that he wasn't willing to assume the burden of the risk, and he therefore is not liable to pay. Okay? Fair enough. I can live with that. So if that's all that ended here, I can live and be happy, and no problem. However, now the Gemara raises a problem, and this I don't understand this Gemara. Hechida, Gemara says, Ilema v'spina zu, v'yayin stam. If the contract was that there was a large wine merchant and he had plenty of wine, and there was one guy who owns one barge, and he is only going to rent out this one barge, then the Gemara says, Im natan amailo ito. Even if the wine merchant paid, why can't he demand his money back? Rashi says, amailo ito. Does Rashi say? I don't remember, but let's take a look. Okay. But the Gemara says, the Gemara's question is, after all, the wine merchant is willing to continue with this contract. I mean, I don't understand this argument, but this is the nature, this is the lay of the argument. The Gemara is saying, the wine merchant can say, all right, let's go on, let's continue the business. Here's my next shipment of wine, deliver it for me. You're not able to deliver it for me, then give me my money back.
You only have one ship.
Okay? In other words, the wine merchant says, I'm perfectly prepared to continue, so that therefore you're the one that's breaking the contract. Because he's not breaking the contract voluntarily, he's breaking the contract because the poor man's ship sank, and he doesn't have another ship. But the Gemara seems to say that since the original contract was written for Yayin Stam and Svina Zu, that there was a specific ship and the owner of the ship can no longer provide that specific ship, whereas the wine was just a generalized cargo, and the merchant can provide as much cargo as he wants, under those circumstances, the merchant can declare that he wants his money back.
So Svenov considered him responsible if he put all of his eggs in one basket, so to speak. He has no responsibility.
Yeah, well, let's put the... But I think that the literal... Almost everybody, all of the interpreters, interpret this Gemara to mean that the wine, since the contract was not specific as to which wine was delivered, to be delivered, just wine, and the ship was specifically mentioned by name, then the ship owner is unable to continue the contract, the wine merchant is able to continue the contract, and therefore the ship owner should return the money, because he's the one that's breaking the contract. Makes no sense to me at all.
Wait a minute, if I have a deal with a trucking company to, you know, pick up from my place and deliver for me on a weekly basis, and their truck breaks down one week, my expectation is they'll go rent another truck or do what they have to do to meet their end of the contract that says they deliver for me on a regular basis.
Yeah, sure.
So I keep giving business their way, and if their vehicle breaks down, they've got that's their problem.
Yeah.
Isn't
well,
this the
I
same
know.
Thing?
Well,
no, but this is a, it was a particular
right.
truck.
You see, that would be very fine. Okay. And no, I agree that that's the proper interpretation. That's not the... I think that what Danny says is the correct interpretation. That if one is dealing with a general carrier, then the general carrier should not get involved with problems of a particular small business. In other words, if there's some accident having to do with some small business, the general carrier should not necessarily have to concern him. Like, for example, you go rent a truck from Budget Rent-A-Car, for example, and something happens to you, I mean... Maybe some power beyond your control. It's not Budget's responsibility to look into the details of it.
They wanted their money back. They get oil
changed.
The terrorists. Yeah, are.
That's right.
They said they can't.
Well, you saw what happened to them as a result. Right.
They wanted their money back. Is there something to the fact that a person pays up front?
Yeah, that's what Reb Nachman said. No, that I can understand. That if he pays up front, he's assuming the responsibility. Yeah, and if he doesn't pay up front, he's not. That's
if. Oh,
I understand that, but that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara is distinguishing between Sfina Zu and Yayin Stam, or Sfina Stam and Yayin Zu. And I don't understand it if it's put at the level of who's breaking the contract or who's not breaking the contract. On the level that you're dealing with, treating it with, namely that I have a general big business and I don't want to get into the details, and therefore if I'm a general shipper, I don't want to know what a particular private wine merchant does have or does not have another bottle of wine. He's come to me. I'm a general carrier, I'm a public servant, I'm a general supplier of trucks or ships or what have you. Then the fact that this guy can't continue doing business with me is his problem, not my problem. And the reverse. If I was Sears and Roebuck and I had a lot of individual taxi drivers making deliveries for me, I don't want to get into the details of their problem. That I can understand, but it's not clear to me that that's the Gemara's treatment of it. Yes?
Well, I was going to say, it may be a way of, I mean, not to be circular about it, of allocating the risk. You must perform exactly as contracted, and I'm not contracted for general service, I'm contracted for this specific performance in this specific way, and if you can't perform in exactly that specific way, see, not so, then you bear the risk. I don't want it. No, I'm going to substitute some other boat, I'm going to do it some other day, it's more or less the same to you.
It's a way of writing the laws, I agree, but I don't see any general principle that tells me that I should write the laws that way.
Well, but it's a way of saying, but maybe what the wine merchant is saying is a level of specificity as to the service. I'm not contracting a general service, I'm contracting a specific service, and if you and that allocates the risk to you.
I don't understand the logic of that. I'm contracting for a specific service, why does that allocate the risk to you? What does one have to do with the other? I can understand that if you can't provide that service because you've done something, then I don't have to take any substitute boat. But if it's not your fault and it's not my fault and there's a risk involved, I don't see why it follows from that the risk falls on you. It's certainly not to me clear.
Because it's more within your control.
Is it? It's not more within my control. The ship sunk. Is it more within my control that I don't have
but
another
boat
exactly?
But you're in the shipping business. I'm not on, I mean, you're, that's... You
but know. But this is just the opposite. I want this specific ship.
Maybe check out that ship in my head.
It says Sfina Zu. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I'm in the shipping business doesn't give me the ability of bringing this ship up from the bottom of the sea. Right. It may give me the ability to provide another ship, but if you're saying that the contract was for this specific ship, I don't see that. I don't know. Everybody seems to be happy with this except me, so I'm not going to argue with it, but it's not a Gemara that I understand.
Okay.
And then the converse. So the Gemara says, where it's a specified ship and a specified shipment. If it's not neither a specified ship nor a specified cargo, but rather
an amount,
then the Gemara says, okay, they split the difference. If you want to split the difference, you can split the difference in all of these cases, as far as I'm concerned. I don't see that there's much of an argument one way or the other. The only thing that I see is what Danny suggested, namely that there's a difference between a common carrier, you know, someone like Budget Rent-A-Car and a specific taxi driver, for example, a one-horse shay, and there may be a difference between a large company like Sears and Roebuck, which has many, many different types of shipments that is dispersing over individual servers. There, I can understand that there might be some difference as to where you want to put the risk. Okay, this is what we have more or less in the Gemara. Now, there's one other, the Mishnah on the next page, but let's pass that for the moment so we can get